What is your favorite sound in the world and why?
I thought it was the craziest thing that we talked about the Rite of Spring a few times, and it was just nothing that I had ever heard before. It was the craziest thing to me, and I loved it.
I like the sound of crackling wood. I just feel like it's nice, but there's still silence in between, and it's just really comforting for me.
The things that come to my head are all musical things. That's what I've found a lot of enjoyment from, probably like an orchestra tune-up or something like that.
Welcome to Amateur Hour, brought to you by BrainVolts.
I don't know if I would call us amateurs, but we're definitely not experts.
We're artists.
And students. How about amateur artists, professional students of sound?
I like it. In this episode, you'll hear from me, Felicia.
And me, Libby.
As we explain what we've learned in our class, Biological Foundations of Speech and Music, you'll also be hearing from a handful of our peers who we've interviewed for this piece.
Today, this amateur professional of sound is asking, is speech music?
Well, no.
It might seem like common sense when I say that speech and music are different from one another, but when you try to draw a hard line between them...
I think that both of them can be very universal.
Ultimately, I think it's the complexity of expression.
We know that music can kind of translate across a bunch of languages.
Speech is such a well-defined sonic event. I think music is a little bit less concretely defined.
See, I am one of the people who believes there's not that much of a difference between speech and music.
It can get pretty complicated.
What do you mean?
For example, it's not enough to say that talking doesn't have a tune, because it certainly does.
Right. I mean, we don't speak in monotone.
We don't speak in monotone.
But can we back up a bit? Like, shouldn't we discuss the basics of sound and human hearing?
You mean for the professional amateurs?
Yeah, and my mom.
Okay, take it away.
I think it's important to understand that a lot of the basics of sound happen at the molecular level. Sound is essentially movement.
Movement of air molecules through space.
But if it's movement, why can we hear it and not feel it?
We can sometimes. Think of the last time you were at a concert. You could feel the sound of the thumping bass because it was so loud. But we typically don't feel sound because the change in the atmospheric pressure, the air all around us, is so small. Let me give you an example. Say your nephew said his first word today. He says, dada.
Dada.
The movement of his vocal cords produce vibrations, which impact the atmospheric pressure by increasing the air pressure on air molecule after air molecule, essentially pushing the molecules back and forth in waves, which we think of as sound waves. Those changes in air pressure eventually reach your ear.
What might that look like?
If you'd like a visual, imagine those popular office desk toys with the metal pendulum balls.
Newton's cradle, right?
Right, exactly. Imagine those metal balls as air molecules. Once movement is set in motion, they are all affected and react, hitting every ball in sequence. However, to best imitate the real world, we'd need sheets and sheets of pendulum hanging row after row in all directions.
So what happens when the sound gets to our ears?
Then it gets a little more complicated. Think about the outside of our ears, the pinna, as the edge of a funnel. This funnel works to collect, amplify, and direct sound. The sound reaches the funnel and slides down the narrowing tunnel, the ear canal, until it hits our eardrum, the tympanic membrane, which is a thin flap of skin that literally acts as a drum, vibrating in response to sound waves. Tiny bones called the hammer, anvil, and stirrup, their names refer to their shapes, in the middle ear then help conduct these vibrations to the cochlea, which is arguably the most important structure in our ear.
So what does the cochlea do?
What doesn't the cochlea do? The biggest job of the cochlea is to convert the vibrations of the sound waves into electrical impulses that our brain can understand. Ultimately, it's the body's sound-to-electricity converter for the brain.
So the cochlea tells the brain what to think?
Not really. Think of the cochlea as the telegraph that receives Morse code messages. It can receive the messages, but can't decode or make sense of them. The decoding of the message comes later.
There's more to the system?
So much more. From the ear, the message follows the rest of the auditory pathway. Our messages then travel along the auditory nerve. Think of it as an electrical cord connecting the cochlea to the brain, and makes its way off to the brainstem.
What does the brain do with the information?
In general, the brain's job is to decode the messages from the ear. Remember the telegraph that was receiving those Morse code transmissions?
Sure.
Well, the brainstem, I'm going to call it a department of the brain, since there are so many team members that make up the brain, focuses on decoding the messages.
So the departments of the brain break up the messages and send separate sections to different departments of the brain to decode?
More like the messages are sent to many departments of the brain. The auditory midbrain, auditory thalamus, auditory cortex, and more. And those departments decode the messages in their own ways.
Interesting. Do some of the departments of the brain decode the same way?
Yeah. There are some overlapping findings between the departments, but the findings from each department end up informing and are influenced by other important functions of the body, such as the motor, cognitive, reward, and sensory systems.
Is there a name for this process of receiving sound and decoding it?
The system of messaging from the ear to the brain is called the afferent system. Then there is the reverse process, which sends more information from the brain back to the ear, called the efferent system. Both systems are vital to hearing and translating sound.
My name is Christian Bordone. I am a second year AUD student, audiology student.
My name is Riley Corcoran. I am a second year doctor of audiology student at Northwestern University.
The afferent is the most self-explanatory because, I mean, you really need that incoming neural structure in order to process sounds that are coming in through your ears or bone conduction or what have you.
The efferent system then is responsible for taking that sound and sending it back out. And when I think of it in respect to speech and music, your auditory system's collecting that sound and the efferent system is then creating that meaning. But both play such critical roles in speech and music processing. You can't have one without the other.
Okay, so now that we understand the mechanics of sound and how it's received by the brain, let's talk about the wonderful world of music.
And speech.
First, let's take a look at how they're similar.
I mean, they're super similar.
Sure, like how they both use rhythm.
Intensity or loudness.
Emphasis.
Articulation, like the relationship between a sound and other sounds around it.
And similar tactics to convey meaning.
What do we call those tactics?
We can refer to all that as acoustics of speech and music. And speech and music really do have a lot of those acoustics in common. There's also the way both speech and music use time.
Time?
Time. Of course, speech and music have different names for the division of time. Music uses measures and time signatures and things that are less formalized in everyday chatter. But speech has its own divisions in time.
I'm thinking of sentences and how we pause when we're talking.
Yes, if we were to compare speech to music, a sentence might be a musical phrase, like a four-bar melody.
And if we break speech down further, we have words and syllables?
Or, in music, single notes, quarter notes, eighth notes, all that good stuff.
Hang on, though. In music, we usually hear drums. We don't have that in speech, unless someone is explaining beatboxing.
In a way, we do, actually. Think about the sounds you make to form certain letters and sounds, like sh, th, and all the consonants. Where music has drum and cymbal hits, speech has something called fricatives. Fricatives are consonants defined by breath, especially inhibited flow of air, like those in sh, f, th, or z.
So those sounds, fricatives, and consonants, in general, those are the kind of percussion of speech?
Exactly. And funnily enough, speaking of beatboxing basically uses consonants and fricatives to form those classic percussive musical sounds with the mouth and voice.
Cool. And I could be wrong, but there's a kind of musicality in speech, isn't there?
Totally. We use pitch when we're talking, like how the pitch of my voice is likely to go down at the end of a sentence.
Or how it goes up at the end of a question, right?
Right?
Yep. Speech and music have a ton of acoustical attributes in common.
But we're also here to talk about how speech and music are different. One difference between speech and music is the timbre of a sound.
Timbre?
Yep, it's what makes a sound different from another sound with the same pitch, duration, and loudness.
Oh, so like when you play the same note on a violin versus on a piano?
Right. They might be playing the same note, but that note sounds so different to our ears because of the instrumental difference. The violin and piano have different timbres because of their physical structures and designs, which alters their harmonics, or overtones.
My name is Kennedy Williams. I'm currently an undergrad at Northwestern, studying communication sciences and disorders. If we're talking about, you know, tones, of fundamental frequency of a tone versus its harmonics, I didn't know of a way to really explain that or understand why that was happening until this class. Like, there are pieces of music where I've specifically heard, like, oh, the harmonics are like a very significant part of this piece, but I didn't know what that meant and why that was a thing.
So even when I think I'm hearing one note, I'm actually hearing a bunch of them?
Usually, yes. There are pure tones that are characterized by just one frequency, but instruments are characterized by the harmonics or overtones that ring out alongside any single note.
Based on the structure and design of the instrument. Gotcha. And this happens when we sing, too?
It sure does. There's even this wild technique called polyphonic singing, where a singer actually emphasizes the harmonics of the root frequency they're singing in order to clearly sing two notes at once.
That is awesome. Wait, can I do polyphonic speech?
It's pretty doubtful. The harmonics created when singing cover a much broader range of frequencies than those created when speaking. This has to do with the sustained nature of singing and the use of frequency fluctuations like vibrato.
I see. And what does the brain do with all this information?
Our brain takes the harmonics and encodes them along with pitch to help us identify what we're listening to.
So harmonics indicate timbre, and it's the timbre that tells me I'm hearing a person yelling, a piano, a violin, a trumpet, whatever I'm hearing.
That's right.
Nice. Okay, well, another way to differentiate speech from music is pitch.
But we already agree that there are lots of pitches involved in speech. So isn't speech musical?
It is, in a way, but pitch isn't the same between speech and music. Let's start with the way we use pitch in speech. When we're talking, we use pitch primarily for intonation.
Right. That makes sense.
Yes. Let's take that as an example. The way you just said, "that makes sense," tells me that you're following what I'm saying. But if you put the emphasis on a different word or syllable in the sentence,
"that makes sense,"
then I can guess that you're being sarcastic or that it actually doesn't make sense, or that you might be annoyed about how much time I've spent explaining this. In speech, we call this prosody.
Prosody.
Prosody is the way we use intonation, emphasis, and rhythm in speech to convey meaning beyond the words themselves. And prosody is an even bigger deal when communicating in a tonal language like Mandarin or Thai.
Okay, so how is that different from music? Pitch, intonation, emphasis, rhythm, this all sounds like music to me.
It's different because music requires a much more finely tuned ability to encode and reproduce pitch relationships.
Pitch relationships?
Yep, relative pitch. Accurate pitch relationships are more important for music than speech. Most musical systems rely on fixed musical intervals.
I'm picturing a piano. Piano covers all the notes, doesn't it?
Each note on the piano has a standardized frequency, with some wiggle room so that the instrument sounds right when intervals are played. These are all specific and fixed intervals, and our brains can really tell if those intervals deviate from what we expect.
Well, yeah, when an instrument is out of tune, it sounds wrong.
Exactly, but the listening brain doesn't have those same expectations of speech. We can understand each other even when our relative pitch is all over the place.
All over the place.
All over the place.
Yeah, the meaning of those words is still there. Okay, so we've got that. The first difference between speech and music is pitch.
Specifically, relative pitch. Relative pitch is what makes music music.
What about the brain science, though?
Right. Speech and music are different in and of themselves, just acoustically, but there's also a difference in how our brains receive and interpret speech versus music.
This is where we talk about right brain and left brain, isn't it?
Yes, but maybe not in the way you might expect. There's this theory about the hemispheres of the brain and how they have completely separate jobs.
I remember learning about this a long time ago. I was taught that the right hemisphere does all the creative stuff, music, art, and general whimsy, and the left hemisphere is responsible for cold, hard logic.
I learned that too. The right hemisphere is the fun, disorganized, vaguely irresponsible side, and the left hemisphere holds everything down with reason and math and stuff.
In the context of our discussion then, the right brain would handle the music processing, and the left brain would handle the no-nonsense hunt for meaning in speech.
It's a nice, clear division of labor for our two brain hemispheres. In reality, it's not quite so simple, although some preference for a hemisphere does seem to be there.
So if some preference seems to be there, I'm guessing if the left hemisphere of your brain is harmed, you'll have an easier time picking up a tune than understanding something that's spoken to you?
More or less. There's a language disorder, aphasia, common in stroke victims, that results from damage to the left hemisphere. Aphasia can make it difficult or impossible to produce or understand language, but people with aphasia can sometimes still sing pretty fluently.
Whoa.
Yeah, there's also amusia, which is the inability to process or reproduce music, although that can come from damage to either the right or the left hemisphere. There does seem to be a preference for music processing in the right side of the brain, but research shows us that music is actually pretty bilateral. It's happening on both sides.
So it sounds like those left brain, right brain theories aren't exactly right after all.
I'd say you're right about that. The hemispheres of the brain both process components of speech and music, but they do so in different ways. For example, the right hemisphere does a better job of processing longer sounds, like notes in music, while the left hemisphere does a better job of processing faster sounds, like consonants in speech. And without consonants, language loses a lot of its meaning. So, although the hemispheres have different jobs, both contribute to how we understand speech and music. Fortunately, we have an integrated hearing brain that brings all of this information together. Amateurs or not, I think something we instinctively know is we don't use small, specific sections of our brains for discrete tasks. We solve problems, like making sense of speech and music, by using our entire functioning brain, or all of the departments. And nowhere is that more evident than in the brainstem.
The brainstem is just what it sounds like. It's that part of the brain that sticks out the bottom and leads out into your body.
Yep, it plays a huge role in your whole motor system, but it's also a key part of the listening brain. Here's something wild. Did you know that the shape of a sound wave is actually preserved in your brainstem's response? It's like the brainstem snaps a photo of the sound.
And I'm guessing the brainstem treats speech and music the same way. It takes a sonic snapshot and passes that information along to the rest of the brain?
And to the body, too. But the fidelity of the brainstem's response is enhanced in musicians. The musician's brainstem captures a clearer picture of the sound. A musician's brainstem does a better job of processing all sound, whether it's speech or music, and then reproduces that sound for the rest of the brain so it can figure out what the sound means.
So the difference between speech and music is that music trains your brain to absorb more depth and meaning from all sound, whereas you don't get that same benefit from just processing speech all the time.
Right. An important distinction here, though, is that the brain training benefits of music come from making music, playing an instrument, singing, that kind of thing.
But musical training of any kind is also a form of brain training.
And it's brain training that benefits all sound processing, speech, language, and beyond.
So some main differences between speech and music are, to recap, one, relative pitch. In music, intervals and pitch have to be way more finely tuned than in speech in order to convey accuracy and meaning.
Two, music processing is more evident in the right hemisphere of the brain, although it does happen on both sides, while speech processing is way more evident in the left.
But there's this superpower property of music processing in the brain, where making music actually strengthens the musician's ability to process all sound in their brain.
Yep, It's wild.
Does that explain that kind of magical ability that music has to move us?
You know, from what I understand, there's a lot that we still don't know about listening and the brain. I think it's safe to say, though, based on what we do know, that the trained brain can draw more meaning from music than the untrained brain.
Sure, and with more meaning comes more emotional and physical response.
So yeah, that's it.
I think we solved it.
I gotta go pick up an accordion or something.
Train that brain.
This episode was produced by Stephanie Condon, Felicia Dominguez,
Libby Lessenhop, and Mia Reggie.
Amateur artists, professional students,
using sound to better understand science.
Thanks to Christian Bourdon, Sasha T., Kennedy Williams, Riley Corcoran, Sophia John, Neil Verma, Shebnam Dundar, Bree Chiapetta, Dr. Jen Krisman, and Dr. Nina Kraus.
Music by Blue Dot Sessions and Libby Lessenhop.